You are listening to the Reality Steve podcast with your host, Reality Steve. He's got all the latest info and behind-the-scenes juice on Claire's upcoming season of The Bachelorette and interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. Now, here's Reality Steve.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to podcast number 183. I'm your host, Reality Steve. Thank you all for tuning in. For the first time in probably 2 months, we're going to talk Survivor on this episode with our resident Survivor expert, Stephen Fishback. So you know we've got a lot going on before I get to the interview with Stephen Fishback. A couple things I want to cover first off. All right. The N95 mask that I've been talking about on my podcast and on my live for the last 3 or 4 weeks. Here's the deal. When I first started talking about that, the shipment was there was a manufacturer overseas that was making them. Those masks are now here in a warehouse in California. So if you order those masks now, you will get them within, depending how close you are to California, I mean, maybe 3 days, 5 days max. So they are here in California in a warehouse waiting to be bought. Right now, the masks are $4.50 a mask. They are KN95 masks, 5-ply. They're approved by the FDA. If you need me to send you the link on comparing what's the difference between a KN95 mask and an N95 mask, I will most certainly do that for you. N95 masks are very hard to come by, and they're basically only going out to government-related businesses. So if you need the link, I'll send it to you. But right now, it's only a minimum 100-piece order. They're $4.50 a mask. You put your order in, you're going to get your mask within a week because they're here in the States. They're in a warehouse in California. So I just wanted to get that out of the way for those who have been inquiring. We've had a few of you who have bought. We've had a few of you who have put in an order and then backed out, which didn't sit well with certain individuals, but it is what it is. Something might have come up. I don't know. Like I said, my dad is handling all this, but I can relay the information on to you that we have KN95 masks in a warehouse in California. They're $4.50 a mask, and it's a minimum 100-piece order right now. If you place your order today, tomorrow, you're going to get your masks very soon because they don't have to come from overseas anymore. They're here. Before we get to Steven, obviously, the Hannah Brown stuff is dominating the airwaves and the news cycle right now. As I'm recording this open to this week's podcast, it is Wednesday at 5 o'clock Central Time. She still has not released anything verbally, not a video, not done a live, nothing. If it happens before you hear this, then maybe the next time you hear from me, which is Sunday night on the Instagram Live with Ashley Spivey, we'll address it. I just have a lot of questions. I really do. I don't know who her PR team is, but they're doing a horrible job right now. Really. It just doesn't make any sense. This happened on Saturday night. It is Wednesday. It's almost 4 days later. How have you not given a verbal apology for what happened? I understand that she's embarrassed. This isn't her. She's getting a lot of heat. Everyone wants a piece of her. I get that. But all these people that are speaking out and giving opinions, the Rachels, the Nicks, the Taylor Nolans, myself, Ashley Spivey, not one of us are slamming her. Not one of us are saying you're a racist. Go listen to anything any of us have ever said. We're trying to educate here. She needs to be held accountable for what she did, and that's all we're asking. Be accountable for what you did. A 5-sentence Instagram story that deletes in 24 hours written by a PR team is not an apology. I'm sorry. It isn't. So come out, verbally tell us you're sorry so we can see it, we can hear it in your voice, how truly sorry you are for doing this, and let's move on and be better because of it. Learn from this. Educate yourself. That's all people are asking. We're not jumping down her throat. We're not canceling Hannah Brown. We never said that. We never said she was a racist. But there is a difference between being a racist and saying something that is racist. What she did Saturday night was racist. That doesn't make her a racist. And here's a perfect example as to why. Let's just say instead of what happened Saturday night, where she was on an IG Live and she was reciting lyrics to a rap song that had the N-word in it and she repeated it, What if she was out Saturday night at a bar, got into an argument with somebody, and somebody not part of her party started rolling film on it, and we hear Hannah get in an argument, let's say, with a black woman and call her the N-word? Then there'd be some major hell to pay. Then I think you could really question her motives, saying this came from a place of hate, came from a place of vitriol, but that's not what happened. What happened on Saturday was repeating lyrics to a rap song. She said the N-word. She shouldn't have done it. It was ignorant, it was uneducated, and she shouldn't have done it. But doesn't mean she's a racist. I have never said she's a racist. I don't think she is. I think she's just ignorant to what she did, and she needs to learn from it. So that's where we're at with that. I think another thing you got to keep in mind is, since Hannah Brown has been named a contestant on Colton season in September of 2018, from that moment until last Saturday night, this woman has had nothing but people kiss her ass, tell her how great she is, amass more Instagram followers than anyone in the history of this franchise, and be given opportunities that very few people in the franchise have ever been given. So what's the worst criticism Hannah Brown has gotten since she became part of Bachelor Nation? You can't give a toast? You know, her first one-on-one date with Colton where she was speechless and couldn't even give a toast? You kept Luke P. around too long? You're an idiot? She's never had to deal with anything like this. And clearly she doesn't know, she's not handling it well, and she doesn't know how to handle it, and neither does her PR team, apparently. But let's face it, I mean, that's just facts. She hasn't had to deal with criticism at all in 2 years. And now this is all being thrust upon her, and she's lived kind of this cush life and this privileged getting opportunities that very few people in this Bachelor Nation have. And, you know, it's all coming down right now. And it's how you act when your back's against the wall. And here we are, 4 days after that video comes out, and still nothing from her. I don't understand it. I really don't. But, you know, we'll see what happens. I definitely think she's going to. I just don't know what takes you 4 days to say, I'm sorry, I never should have said that. That was ignorant of me. Please do not attack people who are attacking, who are giving their opinion about me. Rachel, Nick, me, Taylor Nolan, everybody who's had an opinion about this, nobody has sided with Hannah, but they're not going after her and attacking her and slandering her or anything like that. They're just saying, be better, Hannah. You got to know that that's wrong. And that's it. That's all they're doing. But because Hannah has got these rabid fans that think if you say one negative thing about their queen, you're automatically attacking and spreading hate. It's just, it's idiotic. It's stupid. And that's another thing Hannah should address in her apology. While she should apologize for what she did Saturday night, she absolutely 100% needs to tell her fans to stand down and stop going after people and hating on people who are just giving their opinion on the situation, because they are coming out in droves and clearly are completely lost their mind. She needs to address them. And if she doesn't, to me, it's a half-ass apology if she doesn't throw that in there, because her fans are not helping her right now at all. All you got to do is look around to see what the heat and the hate that Rachel is getting, the heat and the hate that Nick is getting. For all they're doing is saying, be smarter, Hannah. Apologize. Recognize what you did. And, you know, her fans are just like, stop spreading hate. You're making it worse. She made a mistake. Let it go. Like, no, you need to be held accountable. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. I don't know. If advertisers are going to dump her, if brands are going to back away from her, if, you know, didn't she just become a recent spokeswoman for Fabletics? We'll see if they stick around. I don't know. I mean, this could be damaging for her. I think it will be, but we won't know. So, yeah, so I just wanted to get that in there before we get on with today's podcast. And like I said, we haven't talked Survivor for 2 months. I've pretty much kept my thoughts to myself. Here and there I've brought it up, but not much. I've talked about it a little bit on my lives, but now we get 75 minutes with our Survivor expert, Stephen Fishback, going over everything that we saw on Survivor 40 Winners at War. So let's get going. Podcast number 183. Okay, let's bring him in. You know him from Survivor Token Chains and Survivor Second Chances. You also hear him on the Know-It-Alls podcast. He is our resident survivor expert, Stephen Fishback. Stephen, how are you?
Oh, Steve, I every time you say that, I get so thrilled to be the resident survivor expert here. Like, truly, I'm like delighted and honored by that.
I mean, there's nobody that knows more about the ins and outs and just basic, you know, we've done the trivia game in the past. I don't have a trivia game for you this time around.
Okay.
However, I do have something that came to mind when we talk about finales that I'll ask you. It's just one question, but I haven't heard anything that you've said about the finale, and I didn't want to because I haven't really talked about Survivor this season. Although it's my favorite reality show and always will be, I have not discussed it much on my podcast or in my column, but now I wanted to dedicate a full podcast to it. I had Dalton on at the very beginning of the season to kind of break it down because he was out there for the beginning of filming for this one, you know, explain exactly how fire tokens were going to work. I still, we can get into that, but
yeah.
I had him on at the beginning and I want to bookend it with you here. So first off, your overall impression of Winners at War.
I mean, I think so much, and we were sort of just sort of alluding to this at the very start, you know, before we got on, was, you know, that so much of what was so great about this season was the way it ended. You know, to have Tony Vlachos, you know, this who was so dominant his first time out and just immediately flamed out his second time out, you know, coming into this season, everyone ruled him out basically entirely. You know, he was nobody was worried about him in the pregame press. You know, I was in a survivor pool with a bunch of like other former contestants, as well as like some big fans of the show. And, you know, he was the only person playing that nobody picked to win. And for him to come out, play such a dominant game, you know, to have this deep emotional relationship that he did with his partner, I guess not in crime, partner in copdom, yeah. Sarah, and then to ultimately win the game was so exciting. I mean, I think, too, you know, to have this cast, which is pretty unequivocally the best cast the show has ever had, some of the best players, some of the most iconic players from the whole history of the show, it was just great. It was just really, really fun, you know, beginning to end.
When I had Dalton on at the beginning of the season, I told him, you know, look, Dalton, I don't know how this doesn't end up being the best season this show has ever done. And my reasoning and my thinking for that was, on any normal season where, let's just say, it's all new cast, those first 4 or 5 weeks, you just don't know enough about everybody. That you don't know what their game is. You've never seen them before. And so I'm not saying that, you know, they aren't good episodes in the very beginning when you're going from 18 down to like 14 or so when you have an all new cast. But it is kind of filler. You just don't know enough about these people. You're not invested in them. But I said, Dalton, when we start off this game, every single one of these people, obviously, clearly, were winners before. We know them. We know they're all good players. So even that first episode, that first vote out, that second vote out, you're going to be like, wow, so-and-so got eliminated or sent to extinction
yeah.
in this particular episode. So in that aspect, I was like, yeah, this is going to be great. And it really didn't disappoint me in that aspect. And I wouldn't say I was disappointed in any aspect of this season. I was a little bit surprised, and I wanted to ask you this, about, I guess I was surprised that the old schoolers were targeted as much as they were. I mean, it was just old, outside of Natalie, it was old school, old school, old school for the first, you know, 8 or 9 eliminations. Were you surprised at that? Or is that something that you think the old schoolers never stood a chance? Or were they on the wrong side of the numbers? What happened?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's a really great point about, you know, just watching, you know, even from the very beginning, we're so invested in these characters. We know who they are. It's like fun to, you know, it's fun, possibly upsetting to like see, you know, to watch what happens to them. And even, you know, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later, having the edge of extinction this season, it was almost, you know, I'm not a fan of that premise for the show, but yeah. I thought here it kind of worked because, you know, it was great to see what was going on with Boston Rob and Tyson and, you know, Parvati at the end. I before the season started, like I said, I'm in the survivor pool. I had really selected a lot of the old schoolers to do the best. I thought the people who were going to perform the best were going to be Boston Rob and Parvati and Kim, who's not really an old schooler, but because these are people who have known each other, who are connected to each other for decades now. And I thought that the depth of those relationships was going to really bring these people together and just give them an edge that the newer players were simply not going to be able to compete against. And what actually happened was almost the inverse of that, where, you know, people were so threatened by those deep relationships that they became the earliest targets. You know, I think, you know, you saw that because, right, Amber was the second person voted out, right, because she's married to Boston Rob probably. And then subsequently, it seemed that all of the people who were identified as being in this tight old school block were the people who just were the immediately the targets by the new school players.
I'm really surprised that it happened the way that it did. Like when I was talking with Dalton, I can't remember who his pick was to win it. I think it was, I just said, hey, who, you know, throw out your pick. And his was Danny Boatwright. He just chose Danny for whatever reason. He's just like, I think she's going to fly under the radar. Good player. People kind of don't remember her, whatever. And my guess was Yule. But once I started seeing everybody going, I was just like, unless he makes it back, you know, on the second chance on Extinction, he ain't winning. We can jump to the end real quick because there's this, I don't know if you want to call it criticism or gender bias going on right now on this show. But, you know, we've had 6 straight male winners and 12 of the last 15 winners have been male. Do you think there is anything to that, or is this just... I don't know. Does this maybe play into what Sarah said on the, I think it was the penultimate tribal council, where she stated her case about being a woman and the gender biases that go along with this show?
Yeah, I think it's two things. And I do think there is that element to it, what Sarah was talking about. You know, I think in the last, you know, so that shift that you're talking about really happened around season 25, 26. You know, it's like up until season 25, about half of the winners were men and about half were women. I think it was 7, you know, whatever it was, 13 men and 12 women up until season 25. And then after season 25, there's only been 3 women. Every other winner has been a man. And interestingly, all 3 of those women were in the final 4 of this season. It was Michelle, Sarah, and Natalie. But I do think, there's...
Wait, no.
Sorry?
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead. You were right.
Yeah.
How could I possibly question you on that? Michelle, Natalie, and Sarah. And then right outside of that, in the top 5, was Denise, who was winner of season 25. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, the last 4 women to win were all in the, you know, the top 6 of this season. I think there have been, like, some significant changes in the show, like, over the course of that period. And I do think, to a certain degree, what Sarah's saying is really true. And I think part of the shift there is that people have really been awarding a more aggressive strategic game much more frequently, and that men are more credited as being aggressive and strategic, where even if a woman is pulling off the same maneuvers, you know, she might not get the same amount of credit. Now, also, to be fair, Sarah beat 2 men, right, in her finals. Yeah. So, you know, clearly, you know, it can't be done. The other issue, I think, is a format change. And, you know, since season 25, Survivor has done a lot to change the sort of fundamental nature of its show. The most obvious example is the fire-making challenge at the Final 4, where now, instead of, you know, having to sort of either politic or win immunity in order to make that Final 3, you can still make fire and get into the finals. Now, theoretically, that should be a change in the format that equally favors anybody, because, you know, there's no, like, necessary gender in, you know, who's making fire or who's good at fire. But it does turn out that practically on Survivor, like, that the people who are cast as men are probably maybe more adept at it, but even more than that, I think that at camp, it's often the men who kind of vigorously assert that role as, like, the fire maker, you know, and maybe there's, like, some male ego in that, you know. In the seasons I've been in, it's always, like, the guys who want to make fire, you know. So, and I think, like, just having that element of, like, practice is a huge advantage. The other big thing is there have been a lot of advantages now being disseminated throughout the game. That really started to change in season 30 with the first extra vote advantage. In season 31, I had the first steal a vote advantage, which really blew up in my face. And subsequent to that, there's just been a ton of this season there's been, the extortion disadvantage. There was the remove someone from a challenge disadvantage. There was the steal a vote. You know, there's so many different advantages and twists. And again, that is something that sort of favors men, both because historically they've been the people who are most likely to go out searching for those advantages. And I think that's because, again, it's like what has happened historically on the show is that, you know, it's like the guys who are going out and looking for wood or gathering, you know, maybe going to fish. And as a result, they're getting the disproportionate number of those idols and those advantages. I think in the last few seasons, we've seen a real shift in that where a lot of women have kind of like realized like, hey, it's always the guys going out and getting these idols. Like, why don't we go out looking for idols and advantages too? Cause like that gender bias that is really affecting, the female results here. And as a result of that, in the last couple of seasons, we've really seen a lot more women getting idols and advantages. I'm hopeful that like maybe there is a shift happening now where there's much more recognition from the show and from the contestants about, you know, both what Sarah was talking about in terms of that gender bias, but also, you know, from both male and female players that like, hey, you know, anyone can go out looking for idols. Anyone can go out looking for advantages. It's not like, you know, the boys are going to go exploring and the women are going to stay around the camp, which I think for a lot of seasons happened. I just think that like those sort of like people, it's so interesting. You're out there and you just sort of like fall into these roles, you know, like you just, I mean, and it really seemed like those sort of like very traditional old school, like almost like 1950s gender structures were somehow like being recapitulated in the jungle. And it was like, you know, crazy. It was really crazy. And now I think, you know, people are kind of recognizing that and breaking out of it.
There's a criticism going around right now that I don't necessarily know. It's not a major criticism, but it is out there. And I don't even know if I necessarily believe it. However, it goes to the point of there's almost too much game playing going on out there to where it's so much from the second your feet hit that island. It's gameplay, 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 and everybody is so strategic, and it almost takes, I don't know, the fun out of it. However, I think a flip side argument to that could be the second anyone gets cast on this show that isn't an Uber fan, hasn't watched numerous seasons, and is just kind of out there to play, they are pounced on by the diehard fans of this show saying, why is this person on there? They're not even a fan of the show. They don't even care. So I don't really know where you can even go with that. I'd much rather have a game cast with 20 people playing who are fans of the show and who watch it. But it does seem like at times it's just strategy, strategy, strategy nonstop. And we can't, I don't know, see these people kind of, I don't take a deep breath and just kind of kick back and enjoy the experience that they're going through as opposed to strategizing 24/7.
Yeah, and I think that's as much of an airtime thing and how that airtime is being used as it is like an actual, you know.
Yeah.
And I think you're right that, you know, there's definitely been a shift in the way they cast the show, and I 100% think you're right. I think in the last like 10 seasons or so, they've really gone after people who are super fans of the show. You know, when I played, certainly my first time, I think my, you know, like 80% of my cast was recruits. I think there was one person or two people who actually audition to be on the show. Now they do not go out and, you know, recruit people on the street like they used to. You know, Sierra Reed, my first season, she was recruited at a taco stand. You know, she'd never seen Survivor before. She was just like a pretty girl that someone, you know, approached at a taco stand. And that would never happen now, you know. So I think you're right that like there people are going out with fans of the show. As a result, they have like much more complex strategies just coming into the show. And so it's not like you have to watch these people kind of figure out how to play the game, which really led to a much slower pace going in. But I also think, like, again, with all these advantages and disadvantages and, you know, Edge of Extinction, there's just not as much time to give those moments of like people taking a breath or people kind of having a goofy, you know, personal interaction.
Yeah.
And as a result, so it's like because of all, like, to me, that was, you know, you're saying, like, is this season just automatically going to be one of the best ever? Like, the reason for me it was not one of the best ever, and I still think it's, like, probably the top 10, but for me maybe the bottom half of the top 10, is because there was just so much, like, stuff happening. And it was always, like, you know, it was like they were spending 10 minutes on this new advantage, you know, and the coin flip advantage. And then they have to go to Edge of Extinction and spend time over there, that we didn't have the chance to really get to, you know, see the players playing the game. And I think so as a result, I think it's like more a function of where the airtime is being spent almost than what's actually happening.
What did you think of the fire tokens as they played out during the course of the season? Here was my thought. I had no problem with them and earning them and, you know, how to, you know, earning it to get advantage. And I get why they had to do it. And I get why there was extinction because, as Dalton said, and I think as Jess said in interviews at the beginning of the season, like, it was tough to get 20 people out here, these winners, because they didn't want to be known as a loser. They didn't want to be, oh, I'm a former winner, but I was also voted out first. I wanted to at least have a chance. And I get that part of it. Here was my two issues with the fire tokens. Number one, when somebody on Extinction gave someone who was still in the game a fire token, we always saw, or gave them some sort of, use their fire tokens to give them some sort of clue, we always saw that person with like a giant blue bag or a giant orange bag go into the woods by themselves and say, I had a message sent to me early this morning. How did that work? Like, how did the rest of the cast not know that person had an advantage? Where were these orange and blue bags during the season? I didn't get it. Like, it seemed like everybody would know, oh, so-and-so just took his giant orange bag and went into the woods. Like, how did this, that, I didn't really appreciate, I didn't like that part of it. And then the second part was like, look, all the credit to Natalie. She is an absolute beast. But it does seem to favor her because she was the first person out on Extinction. She clearly had way more opportunities to win back advantages, and it gave her three different advantages to get back in the game when we had that last final challenge to get back in the game in the finale, as opposed to somebody like Nick, who had just been voted out. He had no chance to win that get back in the game opportunity. None. You know, now, granted, Natalie struggled right off the bat, and it actually was closer than it probably was. But if Natalie doesn't struggle right off the bat, she runs away with that, and it's not even close. You know, it seemed like, I understand you have to give people on Extinction something to play for, but it seems like, well, the earlier you get voted out, the better chance you have of getting back in the game, because Natalie just killed it with fire tokens. I mean, she accumulated, what, 14, 16 by the time she was out there?
Yeah, it was some crazy number. I don't remember the exact number. I mean, although, you know, if you contrast Natalie with Amber, who was voted out the next day, you know, I don't know if, you know, how many fire tokens did Amber have? You know, probably like one or two. You know, she was there effectively as long as Natalie was. Yeah. And she certainly didn't, you know, amass at all as impressive a resume, you know, in terms of like going out, like constantly pushing herself, you know, seeking out these fire tokens, winning advantages. I agree, though. I mean, you know, first of all, I think we need to, you know, like you're saying, we should, like, just, you know, give Natalie credit for the incredible accomplishment of being that first person voted out and still having, you know, the wherewithal and the fortitude to fight her way back into the game at the very end and to come in second. It's crazy.
Yeah.
But I agree. Like, it's a completely unfair disadvantage to the people who actually did better on Survivor, you know, like the Knicks, who, you know, basically had no chance because he did extraordinarily well in the game itself, or Jeremy.
Yeah.
And I also found that like really frustrating. I mean, that just seemed like it should be a format issue, you know, like maybe, you know, what if instead of giving, you know, what if, you know, there were three starting lines to begin with, and like the first few people voted off were at the farthest starting line, and then the people most recently voted off were at the, you know, the closest starting line. And then what the people who were voted off first have is an opportunity not to get ahead of the people who were voted off at the end, but to just even up with them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, if like the advantages that Natalie had, instead of putting her so far out that it was almost impossible for anyone to catch her, just gave her the chance to start at the same place as like someone in Jeremy and Nick, I think that would have been a real equalizer, mm-hmm. where, you know, people who did better in the game of Survivor would have a better chance at the end, and people who worked hard at the edge would have a better chance at the end, but it wouldn't be so disparate.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but that's a really good point that you made. I could see something like that. Now, who knows if future seasons are going to have extinction and we're going to have this same deal going on. We don't know, because we don't even know when the next season is going to be filmed. It's it would have been, I mean, if the virus doesn't hit, I think season 41 would have already been in the can, right? And they'd be coming up on 42, or would they still be, would they be at the end of season 41 right now if filming could have taken place?
Well, Dalton Ross tweeted out today that today was the day he was supposed to fly out for season 42 pregame press. So I guess they would have been starting to film 42.
Yeah.
You know, with regards to Edge of Extinction, Jeff had kind of verbally committed at the start of this season to not bring it back, at least for a while. He didn't completely absolve himself of the right to bring it back in the future, but he did say, you know, at least for the next few years, they would, because the fan backlash to the Edge was so extreme. You know, I think a lot, like everyone, I mean, not everyone, but you were actually, am I misremembering that? I think you actually were not as anti the Edge of Extinction as others were. Maybe I'm misremembering that.
No, I was never for it for the sole reason that the main reason I think that you have said it and that Dalton have said it is the main point of Survivor is getting your torch snuffed. And when there's an extinction, yeah, you're getting your torch snuffed at Tribal Council, but you're still in the game. It kind of defeats the purpose of everything. I've never liked that. But I do understand why they did it for 40, because you probably couldn't have got some of these people to come back and all winners cast to come back, because they would have said, look, some of us are getting voted off first, second, third, and we don't want that on our resume. We want to be able to fight and at least have a chance. And so I get why they did it for this one, but that's also why I can't rank this as the best season ever, because it has extinction attached to it. No season that has extinction attached to it, I don't think we could ever rank as the best season in the show history, because it's just not right. Goes against the Survivor.
I totally agree with you. And you know, as a viewer, like, you know, it was nice to be able to still see those guys in a way where, you know, in season 38, when they had the Edge and, you know, we had no idea who any of those people were. And it's like, I don't need to see more of, you know, I mean, for those who remember season 38, the first person voted off Reem was like a wonderful presence on the show. And she was super fun to watch on the Edge. But for basically everybody else, it's like, you know, you didn't need to follow Keith's journey anymore after he was voted out. So, you know, some people have suggested that 38 was like a trial run for 40 and like in terms of having the Edge. And that's not inconceivable that it was always really intended to be here for the winter season. But I'm with you. I think any season with the Edge is inherently got a big asterisk next to it. There's so much that's wrong with it just in terms of, you know, the way people can play to the jury and the way jury information is making its way back into the game. You know, the very fact that the people who are voted off first are helping to choose a winner, you know, like some of them had never even met. You know, the people who they were voting on, which is always really frustrating to not, you know, I am not a fan of the Edge and, the Edge.
You'll know the answer to this right off the top of your head, because I don't, other than I know two, Winners at War and Edge of Extinction. How many other seasons had an Edge?
Well, so there was, I am actually not going to remember the exact number. There was a Redemption Island.
Yeah.
I mean, so those are the only two with like the Edge of Extinction as it exists. There was a Redemption Island where people could kind of like play their way back into the game. And I think that started in season 22, Redemption Island.
Yeah.
Definitely in 23. And it might have even just been, well, no, because also they had it for the Blood versus Water seasons. So it might have been four or so seasons that had that twist. Totally could be misremembering. But I think it is four seasons that had that, you know, plus the Edge in this, so maybe six total. I really could be miscounting, but you know, I think it's such a, it just really robs kind of what you were saying before. It robs Survivor of like what is the most fundamental, you know, elemental part of the show, which is you have lost, your torch is snuffed, you are gone, you know, and you are like, you know, and to suddenly you're like only half gone. It just like kills some of the drama of the show.
Yeah, it's the major drama. The major drama should be at the end of the episode, we are seeing some person leave the island and have no chance to win the game. That should be it. Final, done, finito. And with Edge of Extinction, it doesn't. It's like, okay, you're gone for now. And it just doesn't. It just kills. It kills that drama at the end of the episode. Even though this one's like, oh, you can bequeath your tokens to somebody else. It's like, okay, whatever. We all forgot as a viewer who they bequeathed them to by the time the next episode rolled around anyway. Like, wait, who'd they give them to? I don't even remember, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And we weren't updated. Yeah. We saw it on the screen next to their names. It would say who had X amount of tokens but we really weren't keeping track of any of that. And that thing that I brought up earlier about somebody on Extinction, you know, let's take Tony, for example, with the extortion clue, which was hilarious. That was that. And I think him building that ladder were probably the funniest moments of the season. Because that guy's pure comedy. I could watch him play every season. I'd throw him on every season I'd watch. but, you know, him doing that extortion letter, which I think she wanted 8 tokens for it. Again, it was like, hey, I got a note in my bag this morning. Everyone had their own bag and nobody ever knew that somebody was going off and had received theirs. When were these notes being put in that bag? Obviously, it was by production, I guess, when everyone was sleeping. It just was that part I didn't get. I understood notifying somebody in camp, hey, you've got a clue, but it seemed like nobody else in the camp had any sort of clue that Tony had gone off with his bag and now had something that could be an advantage to him. It just was too haphazard to me.
I agree. That's a really great point. It's funny that you're like, you really like zeroed in on this because I hadn't really thought about it. But I do agree that it like adds to the corniness of the show when there's like an obvious lie that the contestants are telling, like, oh yeah, a note appeared in my bag. You know, like, I feel like we're all savvy enough TV viewers now to know, like, hey, production gave them a heads up. You know, there's something for you. You know, like, just be open about it, you know, and it almost like it becomes sillier when there's like this artifice around it of like, oh, you know, I remember when we were there, it's always like you could never say like the idol got hit or production hit the idol. It's always like Jeff hid the idol. And it's like, come on, like no one thinks Jeff Probst is like sneaking around in the swamps hiding idols, you know, like I think actually Survivor is on a good trajectory in that respect. You know, this season they were much more open about pregame alliances than they've ever been or pregame relationships. You know, in every returning player season, those relationships are a huge part of what happens. And, you know, as a result, in the past, when they've kind of elided those stories, it's always felt a little bit like untrue. But here they were totally forthright about it. And I love that. You know, there was all this fear that Ewell had about a poker player alliance. You know, so much came into, like, you know, there was a whole storyline about Michelle and Wendell's, like, past romantic relationship, you know, whatever it was, whether they were dating or they just kicked it. Yeah. And I think that like they did such a good job with that. And I agree, like, some of the other, like, just kind of mechanics, just be, like, straightforward. Like, hey, like, you know, the producers bring them over and they're like, well, guess what you've got? I mean, I'm more bullish, it sounds like, on the idea of the fire tokens than you are. So are you – you don't like the idea of the fire tokens. Is that right?
You know what? I don't hate it. I guess I didn't like the execution of it. I think maybe now that you even just said it, this just popped into my head. Why not just tell them when they're off filming an ITM or a confessional, whatever? That's when a producer can be behind it, the mic, and just say, by the way, you know, as they're filming Jeremy, you know – Jeremy or Tony sitting under a tree giving their thoughts on what's going on at camp. By the way, Jeremy, you've been bequeathed an advantage here from someone.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
Do it then.
Like, see it. Yeah, then you see them react to it, like, yeah. The actual like excitement of the moment.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to we're seeing them when they get out there and opening up. They already know they've got it in their bag, and they're just opening it up. And again, we never saw these bags outside of when they were in their in their jungle alone with it. I didn't get it.
It's so funny that I totally didn't notice that. It's so funny that you just honed in on it.
But I guess I'm not. Yeah, it was more the execution. I think I'm fine. It certainly could be tinkered with because this is the first season we've ever had fire tokens. So they can certainly tinker with it. I think bartering and stuff like that, and you know, bribing some people to do this, you know, you do this, you'll get a certain amount of fire tokens, which could give you an advantage later on in the game. You know, when you're 40 seasons in, you kind of got to change some things up. I get that. I'm fine with it. Just the execution of it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, know, there's a show that I love. There's this South Korean game show called The Genius, which had an economy. And it was so fun the way that the players were just like really innovative within this economy. And, you know, that felt like lightning in a bottle in terms of like how great the players were and like kind of like coming up with ways to use the economy. And I think, you know, this, like you're saying, like a lot of the issue here was execution. One of the big issues, I think, for the players was that they didn't know what the fire tokens were going, what was going to happen with the fire tokens, you know? So I think they all had these, like, this huge anticipation about what the fire tokens were going to be. I think Yule or maybe Wendell had a confessional at one point, like, oh, we all think the fire tokens are going to turn into idols, you know? And so I think because they were all anticipating such a huge payoff for having fire tokens, and then at the end it was like, that's it. Did you buy a tarp? Do you want to buy rice? You know, it was kind of a letdown almost. Because they were like waiting for something like almost magical to happen with their fire tokens, we didn't see as much barter, you know, people bribe, like as many bribes, like vote buying, whatever, as there could have been. And I, you know, maybe the next time out, like people, they're because people are more aware of the value of fire tokens, they'll be, the players will be better at kind of using them. And I do think that's one place that Survivor sometimes misses is when they keep secrets from the players, you know, like, what's exciting for me as a viewer is seeing the way players kind of create strategies based on the game that they, you know, the knowledge of the game. But if players are just sort of trying to like hold on tight because some crazy new twist is going to appear out of thin air, you know, then you never really get to see them kind of plan and execute a coherent strategy.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I want to move on to Tony real quick because he was the star of the season. And, you know, I know I got to believe in 40 seasons, and I know it's happened, at least I think I know it's happened. You would probably know the exact names of people who won the game but also had not one vote cast against them. Do you know off the top of your head some of those?
Well, JT was the first person to ever do that. He actually won my season. So it was the first
token
time
chains,
that,
yeah,
in Token Chains, that someone had won the game and never had a vote cast against him. I think the other two are, I mean, I think Cochran did it in 26. Which is Survivor Karamoan.
Yeah.
And I think Adam Klein might have done it. I'm not sure. Adam might have had votes cast against him. I'm not totally sure. I know that Adam won all of the jury votes. Oh, I guess like Tony didn't win all the jury votes. It used to be that the perfect game was winning all the jury votes, never getting a vote cast against you, and then also winning fan favorite back when that was a thing. Yeah, so I'm sure there are a handful that I'm not thinking of as well in terms of who's won the game and never had a vote cast against them. But yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. It really is incredible that Tony, who was so clearly dominating the game, you know, everyone on the jury recognized it. You know, Natalie came back and told them that Tony was the guy to beat, and still no one voted for him. I mean, Tony won 4 immunity challenges, so that was part of the issue. But there were, you know, quite a number of immunity challenges that he hadn't won.
Yeah, it was, I couldn't believe, I feel like we say this a lot, though, when we get to the end and the winner happens and Jeff was sitting there on the reunion show saying, you guys had a chance to take this person out and you didn't. What happened? And then some people just like shrugged their shoulders and whatnot. But Tony, it's not like Tony is a guy that flies under the radar either. I mean, this guy's making deals with so many different alliances. He's outspoken, but I really do think he changed his game this time around from when he won Cagayan, for sure. I really think that he tried to develop more personal relationships and did not fly off the handle as much as he did in, you know, what was the middle season there where he was voted out early? What was it?
Game Changers,
yeah.
It was the second off, I think.
Yeah, and he was too spastic, I guess is the word you want to call it. He's just too all over the place. And this one, he did some things, you know, he created the spy nest this time and it worked to his advantage a couple times.
Yeah.
But it was amazing to watch this guy control the game as much as he did and kind of be out in front of things. Remember in the finale telling Sarah, I'm telling you, Natalie has an idol. And Sarah's like,
yeah,
absolutely not. She absolutely does not have it. And then at the tribal council, we see Natalie play it. And Tony's like, I told you. And,
yeah,
you know, it seemed like he knew everything that was going on with everybody, never gets a vote against him, dominates the vote 12-4 to win this thing. just an awesome performance.
Yeah, really incredible. I mean, you know, I think the vote of the season, the biggest move of the season from my perspective, was when Tony voted out Sophie, you know, and because what he did there was, you know, there seemed up to that point to be these two alliances that were really going at each other. You know, there was on the one hand, you had Sarah and Sophie and Tony and Nick. And then on the other side, you had, you know, that, well, I guess what we're calling the poker player group, which was like Tyson and Jeremy and Kim, and, you know, Denise seemed to be with them at that point in time. And Tony saw that, you know, his best ally, Sarah, was getting too close with Sophie. And so he got the other group together to vote out, he didn't even get the other group. He created his own new group and had them all vote out Sophie. But meanwhile, everybody else was voting against each other. So, you know, the fact that he still had Sarah, you know, voting against, I think it was Jeremy, right? That was supposed to go home that driveway. You know, he did such a good job of isolating his allies and making everyone else enemies. You know, everyone else is voting against each other, but Tony is the only one who's friends with everybody. You know, and we certainly saw that with Jeremy, where Tony was the one guy who every week kept saving Jeremy and kept saving Jeremy. And meanwhile, Tony's also plotting to get rid of Jeremy. But, you know, from Jeremy's perspective, who else is he going to trust in the game since literally everyone else is against him? So I think Tony was so masterful in the way that he got, you know, he got to like, he would let like Kim and Denise vote against Jeremy, you know, breaking that alliance, and then he would save Jeremy. So he's like the only one who's friends with everyone. It's just so incredibly well done, you know, because I think as much as people talk about Tony's great strategic game, I think he had a really fantastic social game too.
I think the final tribal with him and Sarah making fire and his emotions after that show that he's not an actor. He didn't whip those tears up. That was legit. He had built a bond with Sarah and he was definitely upset to see her go. But, you know, I'm under the impression that his social game, like you said, was just as good as his gameplay, for sure, this time around. And I don't know if you could say that in past seasons for him. Certainly not in Game Changers. I mean, he wasn't around long enough to develop anything like that.
And not in Cagayan either, I think. I mean, you know, people really liked Tony, but it seemed like he had this ally, Trish, who was constantly having to smooth things over for him. Now, it's possible that Sarah played that role to a certain degree for him in this season, too, where I think, you know, without Sarah's really tight social bonds to some of these players, you know, like Kim and Sophie, you know, it's possible that it wouldn't have gone as smoothly for Tony. But, you know, I think that's true of any winner, right? You're always reliant on the alliance that sort of surrounds you. I mean, the mystery to me is why people, you know, there were a few times when people had planned shots at Tony, you know, Tony would win immunity. Why would they not vote out Sarah in those moments? You know, there was one in particular, I think, I don't remember who went home. It was, I don't remember who went home that episode. It was like everyone was ready to do a Tony vote. Tony wins immunity. And then it was like, maybe it was like him who went home or something. I mean, I honestly don't remember who went home that episode, but I think it might've been Kim. But you know, why were they not then immediately jumping to vote out, you know, Sarah instead? If you have the numbers to vote out Tony, why are people not then making the leap? And what I think was so impressive about Tony's game and Sarah's game is that they're playing against, you know, these aren't idiots. These aren't new players. These are all players who have won their seasons before. You know, they're all players who know what it takes to win. And the fact that somehow these two people were able to completely blindside and, you know, manipulate these very experienced players makes their performance all the more incredible.
Okay, here's where my trivia question comes in. I think I've actually might have asked you this one, but if I did, whatever, you're going to nail it anyway. And as I'm looking at it, because I have the Wikipedia pulled up of all the seasons, I just thought of something else that I think we need to change. Name all the seasons where the winner shut out the other two players.
Okay, so I'm pretty sure. So I believe I think it was, well, definitely I think was Fiji the first one.
And then
Token Sheens, I was there. I think that was the second one.
It went Earl in Fiji,
JT
over you in Token Sheens.
And I think the next time it happened was Cochran and Karam Owen, unless I'm Boston Rob actually Philip actually got a vote from Ralph in season 22.
Correct.
When Boston Rob won. So I think the next time it happened was John Cochran and Karam Owen. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
And then I think it was Adam Klein in Millennials. Oh, no. I was there for the next one. It was season 31. It was Jeremy shut out Spencer and Tasha in Survivor Cambodia.
Yep.
And then Adam Klein in Millennials versus Gen X. And I think that might be the last one before. Well, obviously this season was not a shutout. So I think that might be the last one.
Yeah. No, that was those were the ones that were shutouts. Jeremy and Adam were 10-0. Cochran was 8-0. JT was 7-0, and Earl was 9-0 on his votes. So looking at it now, and basically the 3-person final tribal started in Yule season. No.
Yes.
Yeah. Yule season.
Yeah. It was right. It was Becky, Yule, and Ozzy.
Yeah. So that was season 13. So we've essentially had 27 seasons. Parvati won Micronesia with her and Amanda in the finals. So that was a 2-person final. You and JT was a 2-person final. But everything else since then, let's see, Kageon was a 2-person final, and everything else has been a 3, if I'm looking at this. Okay.
And Kageon was Tony's first season where he beat Wu.
Yeah. So we're looking at 24 seasons of 3-person finals. Let me see here. Let me just add this up in my head. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What do you think I just added up?
The shutouts? No.
That I just added up how many of the in the 3-person final, the third person, how many votes they got. Only times in 24 seasons of 3-person finals has all 3 people gotten at least 1 vote. And that third person, all 5 times, only got 1.
It's almost like a throwaway vote or it's like a personal vote. There's almost always someone who's just completely shut out of that.
So does this mean we need to go back to 2? Because it looks like, you know, you look at some of these votes. I think we went over this in one of our first podcasts together. The first 10 seasons of this show, you know, votes were 4-3, 4-3, 5-2, 4-3, 4-3, and then back-to-back 6-1s with Jenna and Sandra, and then Amber and Chris won 4-3 and 5-2. And that's the first 9 seasons. So 7 of the first 9 seasons were very close, you know, somewhat close. Ever since then, it's kind of widened, and it seems like, you know, with 5 of the 24 seasons of 3-person finales, only 5 times has all 3 gotten a vote, and those 5 times, the third person only got 1 vote. It's like the third person doesn't really need to be there. This is a 2-person race, you know?
I think the problem is that it's the third person in those situations who's often going to be, you know, in there anyway. You know, it's the person who is that goat who nobody's going to vote for, who's going to make it to the finals regardless. And I think that's why they have the 3-person season, is because, you know, for a lot of these seasons, it was, you know, these people were coming in third who seemed to be the most dominant players of the season. I mean, in Survivor of the Amazon, you had Rob Cesternino, you know, he was in third. In Survivor Pearl Islands, you had Johnny Fairplay, who was a huge player, you know. There's so many. There's Rafe in Guatemala. It almost became a point where, you know, the person, you know, or in Palau, there was Ian was third, where you wanted to see the showdown between the first and the third person, not the first and the second person. And, you know, and so I think that, you know, even if they went back to a final 2, what we'd see would probably be more extreme blowouts where the person who gets taken to the end is the person who there's no way they're going to win. And so it becomes less drama, actually, instead of more drama.
I see what you're saying. Okay. No, that makes sense. I wasn't thinking outside the box there. Outside of, Ghost Island with Wendell and Dominic, which ended up in a tie, There has not been a close final. Let's see here. In just going backwards, 12-4, 8-2, 9-4, 7-3, 5-2-1, 7-3-0, 10-0, 5-2, 10-0, 6-1, 5-2, 8-1, 7-1, 8-0, 6-1, 7-2. 6-3 was the closest vote we've had. So three votes separating first and second place, and that was Sophie in South Pacific over coach. That was the closest one we've had. And before that was Judd over Chase Rice, which is kind of funny to think Chase Rice was on the show.
And almost like the best thing that happened to that guy was losing Survivor. I mean, if he had won, it would be a totally different trajectory. Like, what a lucky guy.
Yeah. But yeah, 6-3 with Sophie is the closest vote we've had. And that was season 23. It was 17 seasons ago. I mean, it's, you know.
Well, I mean, there was that Wendell Dominic season, where it was an actual tie. I mean, no, and I agree with you. I mean, you know, I think that's probably, you know, I think that the juries are probably forming more consensuses than they used to. You know, I think that it used to be more of sort of like point of pride in the jury house to not talk about the season. And now I think kind of everyone is sort of hashing it out while they're in the jury house and people are kind of coming to a decision together. So I think that's probably forming as much, you know, that's probably as much of the issue as anything. Like truly, if they wanted a better game, they would separate. I mean, it's not logistically feasible, but if they could actually separate out the jury from each other, I think that would significantly impact the way the end game played out.
And that the jury does not see each other until that final tribal when they make their votes?
Or they show up and they see each other at tribal council, but they don't interact outside of that. No, I really don't think that's a practical solution.
Yeah.
You know, just both because of like the staff that would be required and also because of like, you know, part of it's such an intense experience. It's such an emotionally complex, trying experience, you know, and so much of the healing that comes afterwards is sort of that kind of communal coming together as part of the jury. But in terms of like the game itself, I do think that it would be better if, you know, the jurors didn't interact. Because I do think there is like a bunch of, there's a lot of like consensus forming in who they vote for.
For sure. This season, the four that voted for Natalie were Tyson. Who were the four?
It's Tyson and Jeremy, and they both sort of had personal individual relationships with Natalie from before the show. Jeremy and Natalie are, you know, longtime friends, and then Tyson and she apparently also have bonded. And then the other two were Parvati and Ethan. And we certainly saw Parvati and Natalie get very close at the edge. And I don't know what Ethan's vote was based on. Maybe something similar.
Yeah. Okay. Couple quick hitters here. Were you a little disappointed at Ben in the end? Kind of, I don't know, giving up?
Yeah, I totally, you know, I mean, I get it from his perspective. You know, he wants to go out on his own. You know, Ben probably realized that he was never going to win the game. You know, he probably saw all the hostility to him from the jury. You know, he got in so many conflicts with people. And, you know, maybe he thought, hey, I'm not going to win anyway. Maybe I can lose by doing something nice for a friend. You know, the problem is that, like, no one gives Sarah credit for the move if she does it with Ben's permission. You know, if Ben gives her the go-ahead. And, we saw him in Ponderosa videos talking about that, you know, that then everyone knows that it wasn't her big blindside. You know, I think if Ben had actually wanted to protect her, it probably would have been smarter for him to actually stay in the game and beat Tony at fire making, you know, and then it would be Natalie, Ben and Sarah in the finals. And maybe Sarah would have had a real shot.
Do you think Michelle redeemed herself from her first win, which she has said since the beginning, nobody respected that win? And do you think that she did a good had a good showing for herself, even though she got no votes at the final tribal?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I don't think Michelle needed to redeem anything. I actually think her first season was great. You know, I mean, I've met Michelle a number of times, and you can absolutely see why she won her first season. She's just so incredibly charming. You know, if you listen to her on, I know Rob has interviewed her. I'm sure she's done other podcasts. She knows the game super well. You know, I don't think maybe she's the most, you know, maybe she wasn't featured as much her first time out because, you know, because she's probably not as, you know, maybe she's not as eloquent talking about the game as someone like Aubrey, but, you know, she certainly knows what she's doing. You know, she had a lot of like very deliberate strategies that led to that win. You know, and I think similarly this game, you know, she played from the bottom. She was a true underdog. She constantly was out there fighting. She made the move she had to stay in the game. She played an advantage for her, for herself at a time where I think, it's possible she would have been eliminated had she not played it for herself. So, I think Michelle absolutely deserves, a credit for a great run.
And then I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask you any. If you were on that jury, would you have voted for Tony?
Oh, yeah. My God. What about you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I don't. Look, I respected what Natalie did. She got all those fire tokens, and I think it is a huge credit. Like, I'm not taking anything away from her, because when you get voted out first, there's a loneliness. There's a, why am I going to fight through this? How I even know? Because they weren't even given, like we talked about earlier with these fire tokens, they didn't know what those meant. And she,
right.
She could have been busting her ass and going on those long trips with that log challenge. And it could have been all for like, oh, you get a 5-second head start. Like, she had no idea,
right.
But she kept fighting. So I respect the hell out of her for doing that. With that said, I would have voted for Tony every day of the week and twice on Sunday in the finals. Like, I just have a hard time voting for not just because the Edge of Extinction winner, because you know what? I had no problem with Chris Underwood winning.
Yeah.
So
that's what I was thinking about. Like that when I said earlier that I didn't think you disliked the Edge as much as I did. Like, I remembered you kind of being, you supporting or being into the Chris win.
Yeah. But if Chris was, and you know why? It was strictly because I loved what he did, where he said, you know what? I'm going to go fire against Devens and I'm going to take the number one guy out. Because if Devens would have gotten to the finals, I would have. And if somehow Chris and Devens would have been in the finals together, I would have voted for Devens. I wouldn't have voted for Chris. But I respected that gameplay so much that I would have gone after. I would have voted. That's why I voted for Chris in that situation. And I hear the argument against it. He played 13 total days. You conjure up friendships with the jury. I get it. Trust me. But for that particular season, let's see, who was it? Gavin and Julie? I couldn't even remember. If you put Gavin Whitson in front of me right now, I wouldn't even remember what he looked like. I don't remember what Gavin looks like. But Devens, I was a fan. I thought Devens was the best player that season, but lost in that fire-making challenge. If he wins that fire-making challenge, he probably wins that season hands down, I would think, right?
I think so. I mean, it sure seemed that way. And I agree with you. I think both, Gavin and Julie did not have sort of the, certainly not the flashy game that even Chris did in his brief time there. The thing that Rob Cesternino said, which I thought was a really insightful point, was that Natalie was actually really hurt by Chris's performance, that Chris did so much. He aced it so well that she would have to at least equal him to justify her win. And the fact that she didn't put herself in fire making was, and that Chris did, was always going to kind of reflect badly on her. If Chris hadn't done everything that he had done and established this impossibly high standard, maybe people would have looked at Natalie more favorably.
And I think some people look at Natalie in the finals as, well, once she got back in the game, she was never up for vote. She had, back-to-back immunities?
Immunity.
And then, she had the two. Wait, there were three tribals where she was safe. She came in with an idol, right? And then she found one on the second one. And then what was the third one?
Well, she won the immunity challenge in the third one, which, that's been part of Survivor since the beginning. But yes, it's true. Natalie never had to actually survive a vote in the whole game. She did not get through one vote where she did not have, from her social politics. And I think that's sort of where, the game has changed too, where it used to be a much more explicitly political game. It was much more about, hey, if you couldn't get four people or five people to like you enough to keep you through the next vote, you were done. That was it. And that's no longer the case.
Here's a fun one. And this is something that I'm curious what you think of this. Obviously there's so many games and so many challenges at this, and all the credit in the world to the art department and the people who come up with these challenges. What's his name? Kirchhoffer? He's the guy that does the challenges?
John Kirchhoffer.
I mean, it's granted, every challenge we saw this season was from a previous season. However, I love the ball in the cage challenge. That's like, I could watch that shit go round and round and round. And I love that they use it Now I think they've used it four times as the very last immunity challenge, correct?
Oh, my God. Steve, I was the first victim to that challenge. So I do not love that challenge. It has horrible, horrible, horrible memories. I lost basically by 1 second to JT on it. He dropped the ball like a millisecond after I dropped the ball. If I had literally caught one more ball, I would have won Survivor. I have relived that moment probably 30 billion times. So I hate this challenge. I hate to watch it play. It's completely traumatic for me.
See, that shows you my lack of, past knowledge. I never would have remembered. I never would remember that you and JT had to compete against that in the last final.
Oh, yes. It certainly, it probably is not as traumatic for you as it is for me.
Was that the first time it was used? Was your season?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, because for this finale, while they were going through it, I think Jeff said, this is the previous three times we've used this, the winner of this challenge has gone on to win Survivor. And obviously that got broken because Natalie won the, whatever you want to call it, the ball in the cage challenge, and she didn't win.
One of the previous times was actually my second season, which was Survivor Cambodia, where Jeremy beat Spencer, Tasha, and Wentworth to win that challenge.
Okay.
Another one of the producers came up to me afterwards and was like, man, how great would it have been if you were in there? And I felt the same way, because I've relived that challenge so many times. There's no way I would have lost it a second time. I mean, I'm sure Jeremy could have beat me, but I have relived that challenge in my mind so many times that if I had to play that again, I am I know exactly what to do. I actually don't remember the other time that it was the fourth time that it was used.
Yeah, neither do I. The challenge itself is, when you dropped, was it just because, was it, mentally worn down, health, was it hot? What was your... Or were you just, was it just a quick lapse in judgment? You just forgot to put your hand down.
It was spacing. The first three balls are pretty easy.
Yeah.
But it's when you get to the fourth ball that you have to really time it correctly. And the fundamental mistake I made, and this was, looking back now, was very dumb. But at the time, whatever, it was day 38 of Survivor, I was not at my best. I was eyeballing it based, and it's, you see that thing. It's got all these loops and twists. And so I was eyeballing where, to time out each of the ball drops. I was trying to eyeball what it should be. And what JT was doing, which is the correct strategy for this, and is to count out the time that it takes for one ball to make the entire course, and then to divide that, however many, right? So if it takes 20 seconds for one ball, right, you drop your second ball at 10 seconds, you drop your third ball at, let's say, 7 seconds, and you drop your fourth ball at 5 seconds. Because I was eyeballing it, I grabbed one ball, put it back in. I couldn't get my hand down fast enough for the next ball coming out.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I really love that one. Sorry, it's so mentally traumatizing to you. Totally forgot about that. But yeah, I really like that as a final challenge. I think they should just make it a standard and be the final challenge before the final the last challenge before final tribal. I think that should
It's a cool challenge. Yeah, it is a good
because it doesn't have anything to do with gender. It doesn't have anything to do with strength. If somebody's better at puzzles than somebody else, it doesn't give them an advantage because it's not a puzzle. It's not based on strength, and it takes probably way more. I like things that are just more mental. And when you're 38 days into it, you want to see who's still mentally capable of focusing for an X period of time. And I think that's what should be a good test. And that game is probably the best test that you could come up with at that point.
I love the original challenge, which is basically
endurance.
Stand here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stand here with your hand on this pole. Cause then it's truly who has the will, who is willing to suffer through the pain to win this game, who is willing. And in Australian Survivor, at least in the first season, they did a version of it where, they were on sort of this wet promontory and the sea spray was coming in, and it was really epic seeming. And they were there for just hours. Now, I mean, I don't know if it's like causing like, you know, serious permanent damage to people, but that to me is the iconic Survivor Challenge where it's, I mean, and you're right that it is, maybe it does favor physical, more physical people, but it just so much comes down to mental toughness. Yeah. And I looked it up. The fourth season was David versus Goliath, where Nick Wilson won the challenge.
Oh, Nick won that.
Yeah.
Okay. Off the top of my head, now that you mentioned the endurance challenge as the final, you know, stand on a lot, you know, stand on this stump and just sit here and don't fall off. The one that's coming to my mind as the most memorable or the longest, was it, I could be way off on this, but I just remember Tom Weston being up there for God knows 11 hours. Wasn't it something ridiculous like that?
Yeah, it was like 13. I don't remember the exact number. It was like 13 or like 17 hours. It was him and Ian.
And Ian, that's right.
And Ian gave up. Ian stepped down. Wow. Like 13 hours later. I mean, you know.
What was his thought process on that? Why did he was just.
Well, I'm sure, you know, he was a young guy at the time. I think he was like his early 20s, maybe 23. And, you know, I think Tom really got in his head about how, like, you know, he had done terrible things as a human being, you know, like there was a little bit more of a sense of like, you know, honor, you know, and duty, you know, back in those days of Survivor. It wasn't pure gameplay all the time, you know. Now nobody would like step down because of like their honor or whatever, but back in the day that wasn't really the case. And you know, Tom just got in Ian's head and kind of, you know, Ian volunteered. He was like, hey, if I step down, does that redeem all of like my dishonorable things?
And Tom was like, yeah,
it does.
And that had to have been the longest one, right? I don't think there's been anyone that's lasted longer than that.
Yeah, I don't think anything has come remotely close to that.
Yeah. And that was just standing on a stump in the water, wasn't it? Or was
they were holding onto a pole. And I think they had like a tiny little platform for their feet. Yeah, I remember Tom saying that even like months later, his feet were still numb from like nerve damage.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, that one stuck in my mind. And that ended up being the longest one. But, you know, going forward, like we talked about, right now, as we're recording this, was supposed to be the day that, you know, Dalton flew out for season 42. We know that season 41 did not happen in Fiji because of the virus. CBS actually released their fall television schedule today. I don't know if you saw this, but they have Survivor in the Wednesday night slot at 8 o'clock, followed by Amazing Race. Now, the Amazing Race that's in the can, that's been in the can for 2 years, season, I believe it's 32. So they have said, like, yeah, this can change, but as of right now, Survivor is in our Wednesday night slot come the fall season. It hasn't filmed yet. I know that this show turns around, you know, that first season, that fall season, they turn it around in, what, 3-4 months? It usually films April into May, and then it airs in September.
Yeah.
I mean, if they do, let's say, you know, restrictions are loosened and they find a part of Fiji that's way less and the testing is all done and all this stuff, and let's say they film it June into July, I would think you could turn around a Survivor season if it ends filming mid to end of July to have it ready to go by September. You know, a full month of editing or 6 weeks? That seems to be enough.
Well, I think they start editing. I mean, you know, they can never do a full, you know, fully finished cut of episode one before the show is over, because of course, whatever, you know, they have to seed the storylines. But I do think they start the editing process before they, you know, are even finished filming, in terms of like getting, you know, stuff to post. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but that was my recollection. I mean, you know, Jeff in the quote reunion unquote, you know, said that they're committed to putting Survivor on the air in the fall, and that then he opened it up to teenagers. He said, you know, if you're 16 or older and you have cool parents, you should apply. So I don't know what that means. The idea, like, Survivor is traumatic enough for adults. Like, I really, like, it worries me to think about, like, a 16-year-old on the show.
Yeah, no.
Maybe they're more resilient. Maybe teenagers are like, screw it.
Yeah. Actually, you brought up the finale again. It's the one disappointment. And look, we beggars can't be choosers. We're living in unprecedented times right now.
Yeah.
But it you know, just like everything that's going on right now, you know, high school seniors not being able to really have a graduation or a graduation that they're used to, college seniors, same thing. It was a little bit disappointing that the best season that they've ever put together in terms of cast, and might be the best gameplay season of all time, you know, had this type of ending of a season where we're looking at people on a Zoom call. Like, it just, But obviously, I didn't expect that. And we knew that was going to happen. We knew that's the way, you know, American Idol's doing it. The Voice is doing it. I mean, it's the way things are going right now. But, you know, I feel bad. We got 1 minute with, you know, with Tony, who literally just won $2 million and becomes only the second player in the history of this game to win twice. And we get, you know, 60 seconds with the guy at the end of the season. You know, it just, it sucked. I wish it would have been different, but obviously there's nothing you or I could do about it. It was a little disappointing, though. It puts a damper on things, but plenty of things have been dampered in the last 2 months, you know?
Well, I do think they could have had, like, some kind of, you know, they always play a reel of the winner's highlights at the finale. You know, it seemed like they could have done a little bit, you know, or just to, like, have a reel of Tony, like, take a minute with Tony. You know, it did seem like, because I knew it was going to be cut short, the reunion, but it was cut so short. I mean, the only silver lining is that it really was probably the best finale the show has ever had. And I do think part of that is because they had more time, right? So they had, like, almost 3 full hours for the finale, where typically they only have 2 hours and then the 1 hour live reunion. Now the finales have been getting longer and longer, and the reunion has been getting shorter and shorter over the last few seasons, but it's still been like 40 minutes, 45 minutes of reunion. And, you know, I think that extra hour really made this finale something really special.
Yeah. It was just jam packed for 3 hours, and it's just like, wow, they really went to the last literally 10 minutes before they brought those three on and said a bit, you know, not really many interviews. It wasn't like, hey, let's catch up with everybody. It was the best finale, but yeah, just the way everything played out, you know, it just, you know, this virus is causing havoc all over the world. And I'm not going to sit here and complain about a Survivor finale when 90,000 people in the US have died, but
yeah,
I'm just speaking at it as a television perspective. You would have liked to have seen, you know, a season like this and Tony get his fair share of speaking about more things that happened during the season. And you just like hearing from the people that finished, you know, talking about his relationship with Sarah Moore and how much it meant to him and how different of a player he was this season. And did his strategy change as the season went on, or is this what he had planned all along? Like, you know, you just want to hear stuff like that. And unfortunately we couldn't this time around.
Well, yeah. I mean, it would have been so fun to hear from so many of these players, you know, like, for Sandra, like, did she regret leaving Edge of Extinction? You know, if she had been stayed for 1 week, she would have been on the jury. You know, for Rob, like, what was his perspective? You know, what was it like to be out there with Amber? Just to get a little bit of catching up from so many of these players, you know, get their thoughts about how they did or how the season went for them. You know, for Sarah, just, you know, to hear from her too. Like, it is a bummer to not get it after this epic season. You know, we've waited for, and you know, of course, just to reiterate your point, like, yes, this is a very small issue in a world in that is sort of got many bigger issues confronting it right now, but you know, it would just, from a pure TV perspective, you know, to have this season that we've waited for years and years and years, right? Like, there's been anticipation around an all winter season, it finally happens, and then to not kind of have that capstone did sort of feel like a little bit of a sort of soft exit. But you know, I do think Tony's victory makes up for any negatives, at least for me.
Oh, for sure. Has he been on either with the Know-It-Alls or with Rob? Has he been doing podcasts and interviews?
Yeah, I haven't watched any yet. I think he and Rob have got one. It sure seems like he's been. I've seen a bunch of interviews though of him that have popped up. So they're definitely out there.
Okay. Yeah, I'm gonna have to go listen to those. I think the only one I read was Dalton's. But yeah, I want to go listen to anything he has to say about this season, because I mean, there's only two-time winners, and I think Tony is just such a better two-time winner than Sandra. I just, you know, not that I'm a fan of Sandra, I just think that Tony's gameplay in these two seasons that he won just kind of beats hers. I don't know why. Sandra also won a long time ago. It's been her, the second season that Sandra won was, you know, season 20. It was,
yep, 10 years ago.
Yeah. 10 years ago. Her first season that she won was season 7. It just seems like, yeah, she won twice. I'll give her credit, but win it in the new age, like Tony has when he wins season 28 and 40. So,
I mean, very different games, and you're right. I do think that it's I don't want to say anything to detract from Sandra's win, both because I think, you know, her game both times was very smart, and because I'm terrified of her fans.
Yeah.
they're passionate. No, but I do think, I mean, I am not one of the people who, you know, takes away from Sandra's win. I mean, I prefer the Tony style win, but I also think, you know, Sandra played a very smart situational game, you know, where, so I don't think, you know, you can, or for me, I still respect that. But you know, personally, I too prefer Tony's game where he was more strategically dominant. You know, he pulled off, more moves, probably bigger moves. You know, not that big moves is a metric for anything. It was such a, you know, I don't know if we can say Tony played the best game of Survivor ever. You know, him coming into the season, he did not have as big a target as some of the other players had. You know, it's like, how do you say, you know, he played a better game than like Rob, when Rob, you know, never had a chance, right? Like, who was ever going to let Rob get that far into the game? But it was certainly an incredible game. It was an incredible game against the best cast. And so, you know, I think you could make a very compelling point that it was certainly one of the best games of all time.
Yeah, he won against a cast that we had never seen before. So he's almost like, he's got to be almost the best winner. He won against a cast of everybody that had played had won before. So nobody can take that away from him. And unless they do an all-winner season again, which I don't think they're going to do, you can't argue almost like... you know, there's some people that said when the Bulls won their six titles, because The Last Dance has been on TV the last five weeks, that maybe the Bulls won in a depleted NBA season. They didn't have some of the best competition to play against. You can't say that for Tony. He played against the best and he beat them.
Well, the previous people who have sort of held that title of being the best have been people who have played against, you know, would have been considered weaker casts. You know, there was Boston Rob and playing against probably one of the weakest casts ever in Redemption Island. There was, you know, and he, of course, at the time was a four-time player, you know, playing against mostly newbies and Russell Hance, who was eliminated early. And then you had Kim Spradlin playing in season 24 against also, you know, I mean, I actually think Kim played an incredible game in season 24. And one of the big disappointments for me of this season was not seeing more of her and really seeing her never kind of get her footing. You know, someone, you know, in one of, maybe Adam Klein, I think this was, Adam Klein just did an AMA on Reddit, and I think he made this point. Someone made this point that, like, Kim made a huge mistake in not voting out Sarah that time that Tony had immunity, you know, I think this is what happened. Like, Tony won immunity. You know, he was supposed to be the target. Instead, it got switched to Jeremy. You know, Kim immediately kind of flipped it to Jeremy, and then it kind of, you know, Tony flipped it back to Kim. So, you know, but anyway, I mean, in terms of, that's sort of a big tangent, but, you know, in terms of other people who have been said to play the most dominant game, it has typically been against a weaker cast. And, you know, you certainly can't say that about this cast or Tony's game.
Yeah, no, you can't. I mean, it's just... It can't be disputed. There's one time in 40 seasons that's only been all winners, and that was this season, and he beat them all. So congratulations to Tony for his second win and his $2 million check. And, you know, who knows if we'll see him play again. I can't imagine you would play again, but you know what? Sandra had two wins, and she came out. So, I mean, maybe Tony would do it again.
I mean, well, it's easy immediately after the show's over to be like, I'd never play again. I'm exhausted. I'm hungry. I've got my check. You know, and then like 5 or 6 years go by, you miss the adventure, you miss the excitement, you miss being on television. You're like, yeah, let's see, let's roll.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. But then again, you just get into this sense of who would keep him around? Why would you possibly let Tony last in this game? He's arguably the best winner ever. You can't keep him around, but, you know.
I mean, one thing we've seen is that whoever people want, you know, I think in this game, you know, I remember the pregame press, everyone was saying Sarah's got to be the first off. Well, Sarah, you know, came in fourth. You know, I mean, in Survivor Heroes versus Villains, everyone was targeting Parvati out of the gate. You know, Parvati was the runner-up. So, you know, those aren't victories, but they are, you know, they are testament to, just because you're targeted early does not mean that you're going to do badly.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Stephen, thanks again for coming on and doing this. Hopefully we will have a Survivor come September. Hopefully things will possibly loosen up. They'll go film in June or maybe even July, and we'll get season 41 underway and start on time as it usually does the fall season in September. If not, you know, we'll play it by ear, but obviously we're going to have you back on in the future to talk more Survivor. Again, this was a great summary of season 40. I'm glad we basically hit on everything that I wanted to hit on. So, again, thanks for coming on, man. I really appreciate it, and we'll be in touch.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And like I said before, it's such an honor and like a delight for me to get to be your Survivor expert. So I'm thrilled to be on, and you know, whenever in the future you call, I will answer. I would be delighted at any point.
You got it, Steven. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And yeah, we'll be in touch.
All right, thanks so much.
Take care. Thank you so much to Steven for that. I could talk to that guy forever about this show. He knows all. A really good breakdown of season 40, since there's just, I really enjoyed this season. Like, you heard in that podcast, there were things I didn't have a problem with the fire tokens. I had more of a problem with the execution of them. But he gives some really great points on just how well Tony played and how amazing it was that this guy was able to avoid votes being put up against him when he clearly was a guy that had a target on his back. Granted, he did win 4 immunity challenges, so they couldn't go after him during those. But, you know, when they merged and immunities became solo immunities, how many were there? 10? So there were 6 chances for him to be voted out, and he never even got one vote. So good on Tony. And one of the best winners ever. And you can't say he didn't beat the best, because he did. So thanks, Steven, for coming on again. Thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. Please rate, subscribe, and review in Apple Podcasts. Much appreciated. And you'll notice that the ads on the show are a little bit different now. It has nothing to do with you. It's just the format. I moved over to a new hosting platform that's hosting the podcast now, so they just do ads a little bit differently. Doesn't really affect you, but there probably won't be much. The main thing is there probably won't be a lead-in to an ad of me saying, okay, let's take a break, because, frankly, I don't know when they're going in. So that's all you need to know. Anyway, other than that, thank you all for tuning in for podcast number 183. I really appreciate it. Back next week. I think we're going to have some Big Brother talk for you next week as well. So, for Stephen Fishback, I'm Reality Steve. This has been podcast number 183. Thank you all for tuning in, and we will talk to you next week. See you.